friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. No, he's not in my studio because, for one thing, he wouldn't have the time. But let me welcome this year's Grand Marshal of St. Patrick's Day Parade, Michael J. Dowling. Mike, you're very welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, when you were asked to be Grand Marshal of the St. Patrick's Day, did anybody explain to you that despite your day job, that this was going to be a marathon of events?
Well, they explained to me that there were many events of these Irish associations, which is pretty extraordinary because many of them go back 150 years, 160 years.
Sure.
And so they did indicate to me that there were quite a number of those. Mm-hmm. They also indicated that I didn't necessarily have to go to all of them.
Right.
I made a decision, though, at the very beginning, because I think it's only appropriate, that if I was invited to any event, I would always go, so that I would not turn down an invitation. So every event that I have been invited to, I have actually gone to.
Incredible.
I think that's important. It's an obligation, I think, of the Grand Marshal, and I'm delighted to have had the opportunity to do it.
I have to read this because it's actually stunning. You, as the CEO of Northwell Health System, you oversee the largest integrated health system in New York State, and in fact, you could say the top 10 largest system in the U.S. 6,600 hospital and long-term care beds, a workforce of more than 61,000 employees, a health system, 21 hospitals, 4 skilled nursing care facilities, and 450 ambulatory and physician practices, serving 1.6 million patients.
Yeah, we see about 4 million patients a year, about 2 million individualized patients. We expand at such a fast rate that we now have about 550 non-hospital facilities. Some of them are very large, like the one that crossed the street from here.
Yeah.
And some of them are pretty small. We're the largest private employer in New York State.
My God.
And we grow, continuing to grow. We hire about 150 people a week.
Mm-hmm.
Every week.
Now, you made reference to the building across the street, an historic building if there ever was one. You know, the United Nations.
The building across the street was at one time the United Nations, and this is where the UN was before it moved into Manhattan. It was in that building that the independence, the document signing the independence of Israel, was signed.
My God.
And it was also at one point during the Second World War, part of this building was a military manufacturing building.
Mm-hmm.
And today we own the building, and we currently occupy close to 500,000 square feet, which is a cancer facility.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the largest, if not the largest, cancer outpatient cancer facility in New York State.
Wow.
So it's an interesting thing, you know, it goes from being a diplomatic place to a military place,
yeah,
to a manufacturing plant to healthcare.
When you took the helm here and when you actually took over what was then known as LIJ, North Shore LIJ, it was considered to be a fairly local hospital catering to, you know, Eastern Queens and Nassau County. What was your vision? We go back 15 years to 2002.
Well, let me just correct one thing. When I came here, it was North Shore University Hospital. LIJ was not part of it at the beginning.
Okay.
North Shore University Hospital began in the early 1990s, and we had 10 hospitals in the health system before LIJ came in. LIJ was
okay.
The 11th facility.
Then LIJ would have been considered a separate...
Yeah, it was a separate entity.
Entity.
North Shore was the entity that began it all. They were the entity that started the health system. And the vision at the very beginning was to create a, you know, high-quality integrated system where you bring together all of the various hospitals working together rather than having hospitals being very independent of one another, duplicating services all over the place, but actually bringing together as one company and then expanding.
Yes.
And expanding outside the hospital, hospitals themselves, because, you know, about 40% of care doesn't have to be done in a hospital anymore. It
right.
can be done in outpatient facilities. So it was about hospitals, but also about building an ambulatory network. We're also, the idea also was to become a major, major educational training facility. And today, we are the largest academic teaching place in the United States. When you measure it by the number of residents and fellows that we train, which is right now we have 1,650 residents and fellows.
Good.
And we also now have our medical school, which we didn't have before, which we're doing with Hofstra University, and we have a nursing school. We have a major, major research facility, which is doing groundbreaking, world-renowned research. We also have a major in-house corporate university. We have our own insurance company. So we have, in the healthcare space, we have all the services you would possibly need, from primary care, where you see your doc in the community, all the way to end of life. And we are very integrated. So I'm the CEO of every place and the entity. So we're organized differently than others. And we've been relatively successful. But, you know, success depends upon you working on it hard every single day.
Right.
If you take your eyes off it, it can slip away from you pretty quickly, especially in a very complex environment like the one that we're in.
And speaking of the complexity of the environment, brings us to the much maligned health care system in the United States at the federal level, at state level, just about every level. And you ought to know a bit about the state level, since you actually worked as a commissioner and a deputy to Governor Mario Cuomo.
I was the head of Health and Human Services.
Yes. Now, is there, from the different levels, we know that for any of us who have come in contact with any doctor, and God knows I've used many of your doctors and continue to, there seems to be a high level of discontent with respect to how medical facilities and those in the medical field get compensated, and, you know, through the insurance companies, and if my information is correct, that has a tendency to get worse rather than better, despite the massive reform in the last administration.
Well, it's a very, very complex industry, and an awful lot of the focus in the press and the media is obviously about what's wrong. But it's very, very important to understand that while there are a lot of things that need to improve, the phenomenal success that we've had on healthcare is unbelievable. If you just think back to a decade ago or 15 years ago and imagine what we could not do then that we can now do today,
it's
pretty extraordinary. So the problem with a lot of the debate is it focuses on the negative.
Absolutely.
Focuses on the negative rather than the positive.
And it's a political football.
It's a political football. You know, if you look at, you know, the survival rates from stroke, heart disease, cancer, childhood mortality, you name anything, the ability to do things today is just absolutely unreal. Now, as you do more and as you do more complex things, obviously it costs more to do this. It was easy to do things years ago because you couldn't do things years ago, so it was obviously cheaper.
Right.
So it's become a political football. You know, the political rhetoric, people running around saying, you know, the federal legislation was a disaster. Every legislation leaves some things to be desired, but there's a lot of good things in it. So when you try to fix anything, you renovate it, you just don't demolish it. And as is evidenced now in Washington, they talk about demolishing what is, but they don't have a clue about what to put in its place.
Yeah.
And the proposal so far that they've talked about would only make matters so much worse, not better.
Yeah.
And
it's again, as you pointed out, you have to build on what you have. You know, taking your own example of
right.
going back 10, 15 years ago, and as a matter of fact, we could go much further back than that too. In Ireland, where both of us grew up, people, elderly people, you know, were reported they died from old age.
Right.
They died, you know, from nobody was able to pinpoint, and probably for very good reason, what they died from.
You
know,
because
they died from rheumatism.
It was, I understand. Healthcare in the last 30 years has become unbelievably sophisticated. I mean, mm-hmm. what we know, the science of medicine has dramatically improved. The technology has dramatically improved. People are living today, just to give you a statistic, people are living 35 years longer today than they did 100 years ago. That's phenomenal when you think of it. It's a combination of obviously public health, better living, of course, but also medical advancement. And so there's a lot right with the health system. Now, there are things that are not so right. It's complicated. Sometimes it's too expensive for some people. Some people have
right.
no insurance. Some people have to pay too much money out of pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people stay in the hospital too long, in part because there's no place else to put them.
Yeah.
But these are all things that over time you fix, you work on, and you fix. And we work on these things all the time. I am just hoping that all of the discussion that's going on in Washington these days don't make things a lot worse.
Mm-hmm.
What they should be doing is focusing on what's right with what currently exists, and try to focus on fixing the things that are wrong. But
for that you need agreement, and you need to take the politics out.
Well, you need to take a lot of the stupid politics out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody thought it would be very, very easy to take Obamacare and just eliminate it and replace it. But
mm-hmm.
they're now finding that when you peel back the onion in healthcare, it is very, very complicated. And if you touch one part of it, it's like pulling a thread out of a carpet. You know, you pull one big thread out.
Right.
And the whole thing starts to unravel, and then you don't know how to put it back together. But I'm an optimist, and I believe that at the end of the day, you know, saner minds will take charge here. From our perspective at our health system, you know, we work to try to make things better for the patients we see, improve the service, improve the quality, improve the access, provide more locations so people can get there quickly, have better scheduling systems for patients, etc., etc. So we're working, and I spend most of my time focusing on what I can do
mm-hmm.
and not getting completely, you know, sidetracked by some of the circus that's going on in Washington these days.
Yes.
Because you can get completely waylaid by that and then not focus on what you should be focusing on.
I'd like to go back to Knockaderry, your village, your parish. Knockaderry in Limerick. Yeah, you won't find it on too many maps, but maybe Google can help us out these days. Can you describe the village, your parish?
Well, the village, for Irish people who are listening in, the village was pretty a typical village.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very picturesque place. It's a farming community,
mm-hmm.
and very rural. And the village was on the side of a hill, basically. The village was made up of just a couple of buildings. It had, of course, at the center of the church.
Mm-hmm.
It had across the street a post office.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of hundred yards up from the post office was the local pub.
Mm-hmm.
You had one little small store.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a couple of other residential buildings. That was the village.
Sounds like my own parish.
It was replicated in Ireland a thousand times. Farming area. Everybody back, of course, in those days, everybody milked cows by hand.
And yes.
Everything was done manually.
Mm.
It was a very nice community. We obviously didn't grow up with too many material benefits because we were one of the poor families in the neighborhood.
Yeah,
it's very interesting.
But typically, you were no better, no worse off than most of the.
We were pretty well. There were other families like us, but you know, I always thought all the farmers around were very wealthy.
Yes.
Compared to the way we were.
Yeah.
Now later on in life, of course, when you look back and you realize that they weren't that wealthy at all, but relative to us, I thought they were very wealthy.
Yeah.
you know,
your parents, if I might.
Yeah, my father was a county, worked in the county council.
Yes.
Irish people will know what that means. He was a laborer. He worked in fixing the roads.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very hard worker. Had grown up in the Knockaderry area. Had traveled by bicycle many, many, many miles to work. But he eventually suffered terribly from arthritis. So at the age of 42, he no longer could work. He was pretty crippled from arthritis, which was pretty unfortunate. But he was a hardworking individual.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was a home, you know, was at home. My mother was deaf.
Mm-hmm.
Never considered it a disability and never believed she had a disability. She was a seamstress. She would do on the side.
Yes.
She would make clothes for people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the time she took no money, so this wasn't a real business.
Yeah.
I mean, she did it all the time, but she did it as a free, you know, for the altar boys in the church.
Oh, I know.
She made all the altar outfits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she was very, very talented at that. My father died when he was 62. From multiple problems, and of course, the only healthcare back then was the local doc, who was you know, in Newcastle West, which was 5 miles away. And in today Limerick City, from my house, because my sister still lives in the same area, when I go home now, you know, to get to Limerick City from my house is between 15 and 20 minutes. But back when I grew up, getting to Limerick City was so far away, I couldn't even imagine ever getting there. Because the only way you could move around was by foot or by bicycle.
Yes.
You know, this is not uncommon.
Yes.
I mean, living in a rural island, and it has changed dramatically, of course.
Obviously. And we see it. Now, of course, being the number one tourist destination in the whole of Europe says something to it. Much of it, when you mentioned there about the beauty of the place, of where you grew up, you know, a great and lovely place. We took that pretty much for granted, though. We didn't appreciate the.
Well, now you know, when you grow up in a place, it's like people who live in New York who have never been to the Statue of Liberty, right?
Yeah.
And visitors come and they say, I want to go to the Statue of Liberty, or I want to go to the top of the Empire State Building. But if you live across the street from the Empire State Building, you don't necessarily appreciate what it is. So, you know, when you grow up in the community where I grew up, it was very nice. If you go back today and I drive by it, I'm always fascinated by the views, because you could see almost 360 from the hill in front of our house. But as a kid, you didn't see it like that. Today you see it like that. Perspective is important. And the other thing I would say, that while we were poor, you know, everything is relative. So, you know, it's when you know the alternative is you realize how poor you really were. But at the time, you know, we didn't have electricity, so I never thought that not having electricity was a big problem.
Yes, well, we in our own parish had the rural electrification had just kind of hit our parish. We must have been at the end of the list over at the foot of the Ox Mountains. But people are in awe of how we had communication, you know, what we take with the television and with the advent of the internet and all the rest of it. How did we, growing up, without the benefit of electricity, without the, you know, how did we get to communicate?
Well, in one way, there was a lot of communication. I could argue that there was even some more realistic communication back then than there is today, because you sat around and you talked. And I remember in our house, the door was always left open.
Mm-hmm.
You never locked the door. So people would come in, sit around the fireplace, because they had a big open hearth, sit around the fireplace, and you talked. You discussed. You got to know people. It was face-to-face. Today, you know, people communicate using devices, and they're not even looking at each other. I mean, I'm always amazed when I go out to restaurants and I see a family sitting around the table and they're all on the iPhone, but nobody's talking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that's communication. So we communicated. Now, obviously, we weren't able to do long-distance communication.
Right.
But local communication. Everybody got to know everybody.
Right.
And everybody, and people helped one another. So in the farming area, when people had to work in the fields, other people helped them, etc.
Yeah. So well, that was the mehel, the concept of the mehel, where again, many hands made light work, but there was no compensation other than if it was the right thing to do.
It was the right thing to do.
And it was the necessary.
Yeah. And sports was a big thing in our village. We Knockaderry was famous for hurling, and I was fortunate to play with all the championship winning teams up along. But at night time, you trained. You were always out running around. Every night we had training sessions. You had games on during the week, and you had games in the weekend. So and on Sundays, the everybody congregated at the church. During the days, people congregated. During the week, people congregated at the sports facilities.
Yes.
So that was another communication mechanism.
Much maligned was at that time, or much later on, when people look back and they really felt that the influence of the church was a tremendous detriment to, to following what was considered 800 years of oppression from British rule, that now you had the church, and that actually they, rather than being of tremendous help, made sure that you didn't get outside the cocoon, so to speak.
Well, that is true. I mean, the church was all powerful. I mean, the parish priest was the most important person, perceived important person in the community. You defer to the priest. If you walk by, you kind of bow to the priest. I remember farmers wanting to till their land, ton the hay on the Sunday, for example, because the weather during the week would be rain. They'd have cut the hay, and you had to turn it, otherwise it would rot, as you know.
Sure.
And the only time that you could do it was on a Sunday, and the farmers just had to go to the priest to get permission to do it on a Sunday.
Right.
And in many, many cases, he declined. And I never understood that then why somebody would say no on a Sunday, and the result would be that that family probably was going to lose their crop and therefore be quasi-impoverished as a result. I never understood that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you can argue there were good things about it, but it was not all good.
Yeah. And also, of course, the parish priest was the ordained manager of schools. So the national school system depended, on the flexibility or of the parish priest, something that, again, solidified the power of the church in Ireland.
Of course, it has changed dramatically now.
Right.
I mean, everybody went to church on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people can look at that and say, that's great, everybody was religious. But a lot of people went to church because if you weren't at church, everybody knew you weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
People would say, where is Mrs. Jones Sunday? Because everybody knew everybody.
Right.
And everybody knew everybody said. And, it was the priest, and it was the local, and the teacher. The headmaster of the school were all powerful.
Yes.
And the headmaster of the school or the teacher of the school could pretty much do anything. And if you ever went home and complained about the teacher, that they were, and of course, they were not, shy about using corporal punishment in the schools.
That's right.
But if you went home and told your father about it, you got it again.
Mm-hmm.
So you never told your parents because the father assumed that if the teacher hit you at school, you must have done something terribly wrong. So I'm not going to hit you because you must have done something wrong. So you didn't go home and tell the father about it. Today you would never get away with that.
No.
At all.
Yes, well, your parents would be, in the courts suing everybody. And let me just ask you, though, about that point, or there were five in your family.
Yes.
And where did you, in terms of, where did you fit in? And
I was the oldest.
Okay. So there had to be a time when it dawned on you, listen, I have to get out of here, and I have to help this family. Number one, what was the impetus? Where did you look at Most people were looking at England because it was only across the water, and there would be a, you know.
Well, I had to preface it a little bit. I loved education. I loved to study, always. Even to this day, my favorite pastime is reading and learning. And so even as a kid, when we didn't have much, my mother always, for somewhere or another, always made books available.
Mm-hmm.
So I read a lot. So I had a dream of wanting to go to college, even though I had at the time no idea what a college was. And also, it was very obvious to me that the family, you know, needed help. So I actually went to England first.
Mm.
So I went to England to figure out a way if I could make some money to help out at home and go to college. And I was around 15 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So 15. And then I went to England. I worked in a place called in Crawley, place south of London. And I worked in a steel factory. And that was the first time I'd been away from home.
Mm-hmm.
It helped. I was able to come home with some money, and I had a little bit of money because during that year that I was in England, I was accepted into college in Ireland, because if you remember back in those days, you had to do so well in the secondary school,
absolutely,
or high school as it's called here. You had to get so many honors to be potentially accepted into college, and there were no scholarships. So you get in, but then there was no means of paying for it. So I had come back from England. I had gone into college. I had enough money from England to actually pay my down payment for college,
yes,
you know, the registration. I actually went to college. I hitchhiked on a milk truck to college. I got on the
street. To Cork.
Cork. And yeah. I hitchhiked. I didn't even know where I was going. The milk truck left me off near the college. I had no clue what a college looked like. I walked around. I must have looked ridiculous at the time, looking for the college. I actually asked the nun where the college was, and she told me I was in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
I figured the nun was safe to ask.
Mm-hmm.
As being Irish and being male, you don't ask questions. So then the first year, I would work in construction. There was a company at home that helped me. I'd work, I was a couple of weeks in construction, I'd come home and work. I'd work during the Christmas holidays in construction, and I got by the first year.
Yes.
Then I decided, you know, back then everybody was talking about if you came to the U.S., there were jobs, and
mm-hmm.
I got a visa, a work visa, and I came to the U.S.
Yep.
And
That was
in 1968.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then I worked for the next 3 years. I would work half the year here.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back and finished my undergraduate at Cork.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got involved in student politics at the university, and I was student vice president. I played sports with the university. I got on the college teams. We won a lot of championships. And then after I finished college, I came back to the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
and I've been here ever since.
Now, when you did work here, again, it would appear that you were able to land jobs that paid well. You worked on the docks. You worked as a
I worked in plumbing. I worked in construction, but I worked terribly long hours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I worked 7 days a week, and I was willing to do anything. I never worried about the fact that it was getting off at work at 2 a.m. was hard, or starting at 5 a.m. was hard. I was so happy. I mean, people ask, wasn't it difficult?
Mm-hmm.
Quite frankly, I didn't think it was difficult at all, because everything is relative, coming from where I came from,
yes,
and the opportunity to work and have a paycheck,
mm-hmm.
and send money home and put money aside for college. I was in heaven. I mean, to me, none of this was hard.
Yeah.
But I'm a workaholic anyway, so I like to work. So I worked all the time, and I was able to help my parents at home. And I paid for my college completely. I never took out a loan. And I worked. I would work. I have had pay slips that show me working 115 hours a week.
Wow.
And I'd worked multiple jobs. I cleaned out bars in Queens and Astoria.
Mm-hmm.
I worked cleaning out schools at nighttime.
I mean,
wherever the work was, I was there. I mean, I want to emphasize, I never thought it was difficult. Difficult for me was to stay in Nakadere, not because I didn't like Nakadere,
yeah,
but to stay in Nakadere with no possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
That to me was hard. But to come here and look around New York and see, you know, the possibilities that existed in this country was just, to me, just, you know, well, typically,
yeah,
if I'm, you know, this is not unique. This is very typical of most immigrants, as you know.
Right. Give us your first impressions. Now,
of
you
New
had
York?
Been, yeah, you had been, it's not like you weren't out of the country. You had some experience by working in England for whatever short period of time. But coming to New York, what was your vision before you arrived here, and how did that differ from your landing, and in the middle of the metropolis?
Well, your image, in New York, my image of New York was that it was this unbelievably glorious, phenomenal place. You know, the streets were paved with gold.
Yes.
Just a place that you definitely wanted to go and see, right? So when I arrived, it was fascinating. The first thing that struck me was the size of the buildings.
Yes.
I remember getting out on the street and looking up, because the tallest thing I'd ever seen was the thatched cottage I grew up in, basically, out of a hay barn in a local farmer place. And then to sit and go walking along the street and to look up and see something 60 stories, 70 stories was just unbelievable. The other thing I remember very vividly is the vibrancy of New York. I mean, it was moving, and, you know, people moving all over the place. It was like hustle bustle like you wouldn't believe. And then the diversity in New York. You know, stand in the corner and within 15 minutes, you know, 15, 20, 30 nationalities walk by you.
Yes.
You know, when you come from a place where everybody is exactly the same,
mm-hmm,
the place is kind of nice and quiet, and now you come into the hustle and bustle of a major city. Remember, I hadn't been to Dublin at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't been to Limerick at that point. I had been in London on my way to Crawley, but I didn't really know London at all.
Yeah.
So to me, it was the vibrancy of New York was absolutely unbelievable. It was exciting. And, you know, I got lucky enough, I got work. And the most difficult part of it for me was not being able to communicate with home.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you could communicate back home, of course, back then, was to write a letter.
Yes.
And that letter took, back then, a week and a half to 2 weeks. So it isn't like today when you can just get on the iPhone and you have instantaneous communication. So, when I got here, I had to write a letter to my parents to say I arrived safely, because they didn't know I had arrived safely.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to wait for them to write a letter back to tell me they got my letter. So it was like 3 to 4 weeks before I knew that they knew that I had actually arrived safely.
My gosh.
It's a different world. But that's the way it was. And, of course, we had no telephones at home.
Right.
And there was a telephone kiosk in the village. So what I would do then is I would write home and tell them that, 2 weeks from Saturday, I will call that telephone number on the church. The kiosk was in front of the church.
Hmm.
I will call that number at 7 p.m. Irish time.
Mm-hmm.
And my family would gather around the phone.
Yes.
And the phone didn't work that well back then. So half the time, it didn't go through at all.
There was no direct dial, that's for sure.
You had to go to the post office where the person stuck all of the tubes in.
Yes.
And then sometime it worked. And then the things I remember vividly was that since my mother couldn't hear, right,
yes,
my brother would get on the phone or something, and or a friend, and I'd always hear my mother in the background saying the following: "Is he okay?
Mm.
Is he eating well?" Right?
Yes.
And she'd get on the phone and talk, but she couldn't hear me.
Right.
See? So I'd have to tell somebody, tell her I'm okay.
Right. Yeah. Do you know, let me ask you about, you were here, you were working, obviously, you kept your eye on the ball with respect to education. You wound up in Fordham. in Fordham University, where you went on to you get your master's and then even you know, served as a professor for a short stint. What was that period like? Did you know where you were heading at that point?
No, I mean, I didn't know where I was heading, other than I knew that I was on, like, you know, if you look at it as a ladder,
mm-hmm.
that I was on rung one or two, and I wanted mm-hmm. to get rung five.
Okay.
I wasn't sure was at rung five, but I was moving up the ladder one way or the other.
One way, yeah.
I had no great vision of what I would end up doing. So I went to Fordham, I graduated. And then they asked me to come teach at Fordham after I graduated. And I took a course, then I took a second course. The reviews were very positive. And then they asked me to come on full-time at Fordham University.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the idea of being a professor at Fordham University was like something I had never dreamed was even possible, especially since a couple of years before I didn't even know what a university was.
Yes.
But it just shows you that there's no limit to what you can do and that you take risk. You take a chance. You persevere. You just don't say you can't do something. So I jumped at it. Did I know how to do what I was asked to do? Not really, but I learned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just dive in and learn. It's like learning how to swim. Dive into the deep end and you'll swim pretty quickly. So I did that for a number of years. And then I obviously took on administrative roles.
Mm-hmm.
And then Fordham had a campus in Westchester.
Mm-hmm.
And in Tarrytown in Westchester. And I became the head of that campus for the department. For the School of Social Service, I was the head of the campus in Westchester, on faculty in Westchester and in Lincoln Center, and I was the assistant dean at Lincoln Center.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd communicate, but I'd go back and forth. The one thing I never ever said no to a challenge.
Right.
I never ever in my life said I can't do this, even though I often went home thinking I'm just asked to do this, and I don't have a clue.
I know
what this means, and I.
But did most of that challenge come from yourself, though? You know, you were challenging yourself.
Yeah, I mean,
many would say you're still doing it.
Yeah, today, you know, I'm always challenging myself. I mean, I'm never happy with what I do.
Hmm.
I mean, because I think if you're totally, completely happy, you're not driving yourself. You know, some element of unhappiness is a key to success, in my view.
A day had to come, though, when you opted to get and to head into the medical field. You could, at that stage of the game, have gone to Wall Street. You could have you were in a position, knowing with your work ethic, and in fact your success. Something drew you. There was some magnet or what
into
was
the health field.
Yeah.
Well, I started out, my whole interest was, there's two answers to that. One was because of the situation with my parents
mm-hmm.
and my father being sick, I was always interested in the human services health world.
Mm-hmm.
That's what always interested me. I also didn't know back at the very beginning, I didn't fully appreciate, I wasn't even knowledgeable about the fact that there were other areas that I could have engaged in. I didn't realize, for example, when I was in college in Ireland, that you could become a lawyer. Because
mm-hmm.
remember, this was a time when there was no counseling for college, right? Today,
right.
People counsel everybody. I had no college. I mean, I remember being in college and thinking, oh my God, there's something called agricultural science. Oh,
right.
There's a medical school. There's a law school. Because I went into liberal arts. Because the only person I ever knew that had a degree was a teacher.
Mm.
So I assumed that's what college was, to train teachers. I didn't know about anything else. But because of my family background, I was always interested in health.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it was a natural progression. When I was at Fordham University, I studied health issues. When I moved into government later on,
yes,
I eventually oversaw health for the state of New York.
Right.
So it was just a kind of a natural progression, I suppose.
Yes. Overlooking the health system for the state of New York, were you frustrated with the lack of progress, or did you, obviously, where you are now, you had very lively, aggressive imagination. When you looked at New York State and the state of the health system at that time, what was your reaction?
Well,
what was your
New
expectation?
I was fortunate in that I worked with Mario Cuomo, who was, in my view, just a wonderful, wonderful individual and a great governor, and very demanding, had a lot of foresight about what should happen. He put a great team around him. Mm. So I worked with some spectacularly smart individuals. And there were criticisms of the healthcare issue back then, just like there are criticisms of it today. So we worked very, very hard to try to improve the situation. And New York is very progressive in this regard. So, for example, New York has programs, expanded programs in healthcare that other states back then only dreamed about. This is where, for example, when Obamacare came in, New York didn't get as much of a benefit as other states because New York had already done it. We had expanded health coverage. One of the programs that I was involved in creating was a major healthcare program called Child Health Plus, which was the coverage of children.
Yes.
That was one of the most innovative programs in the country and became the template for the national program on health insurance for children. So I was involved in that. I was also involved in job creation and requiring people on public assistance to go to work and get jobs and get training, etc. So I think over the course of the time that we were there, we made a lot of great progress.
Absolutely.
I mean, I look back and it was phenomenal. Now, it was also a time, by the way, when the economy was not doing well. So we went through some, you know, from recession to recession during that period of time. So we were always struggling with the state budget, always struggling trying to figure out how to balance the state budget, but at the same time protecting the safety net for people so that we didn't disproportionately hurt people at the bottom of the income ladder. And I feel, you know, happy that we, for the most part, we succeeded in doing that, as difficult as it was. And I became very close to the governor. And the governor's family.
Yes.
And I have the utmost admiration for them. And, you know,
and
to me,
that
experience for me was like, did I learn and grow during that period? Oh, yeah. I mean, I was thrown into the hot seat in that situation, and I had to either sink or swim pretty fast. But I learned, you know, quickly. I didn't have all this time to study it and train for it.
Yeah.
I was thrown in, and now all of a sudden it's yours. Now do it. So, and I'm happy in those situations.
Transferring to, you know, from a government position and now coming into, you know, a private hospital system, one which was considered, you know, mediocre in the large scale of things. What order did you see? What did you envision at the time?
Well, I knew a little bit about, because of my involvement at the state, I knew a little bit about North Shore University Hospital. I realized that it was a great place. There were phenomenal things going on. The issue that you have in New York is that if you're a hospital in Manhattan, everybody thinks you're better than everybody else. Just by the fact that you're actually located in Manhattan. And so New Yorkers or Manhattanites have this attitude that if anything good has to happen, it has to happen in Manhattan. And that, to me, is garbage. Some of the best programs that were going on at the time were not happening inside New York, Manhattan at all. They were outside. So I looked at New York, at North Shore, and I saw North Shore as having the potential to be as good, if not better, than any of the places in New York. It had a, you know, it had a wonderful core. It had wonderful core attributes. But we wanted to create something different. We wanted to pull together all of the hospitals out here and make them work as one. And share information, share talent, share resources, and build a health system, not just build individual hospitals. And we did that for years and years and years before any other hospital in New York attempted to do the same thing. So we were first out of the gate. We had created a 10-hospital system before anybody in New York started to actually create anything similar. And then, of course, in a couple of years ago, we moved into New York City, Lenox Hill, for the same reason. I wanted to have a presence in Manhattan because let's be honest, I mean, before we moved into Manhattan, it was hard to get the press to pay attention to us.
Sure.
We took over Lenox Hill, and all of a sudden, the phones are ringing.
Right.
Just because we're in Manhattan.
Yeah. If some of those, you know, who felt that being a Manhattanite, or at least having the benefit of a Manhattan hospital, I suppose Lenox Hill would have been one that had a great reputation.
Yes.
And now it's becoming an add-on to Northwell.
Well, you know, Lenox Hill was a premier place in Manhattan, and some of the key developments and discoveries in medicine occurred at Lenox Hill.
Yeah.
But it went from the 1980s. During the 1980s and 90s, Lenox Hill began to slide downward.
Yes.
You know, it, for a whole variety of complex reasons, it started to lose ground. So when we moved in to take it, it was in pretty bad condition.
Yeah.
It had good bones, but it was losing. So we took it over and we have built it back up. So it is, becoming a major player again. We're doing stuff at Lenox Hill at the moment that most other places don't even do. And we are going to continue building and evolving Lenox Hill. So I would dare say that if we hadn't dealt with Lenox Hill at this time, or we hadn't taken it over, I doubt very much that it would survive,
yeah,
or have survived. And I think it's because of the history it's had. It's important that Lenox Hill survive and grow. But it changed the health system. It changed the whole organization by having the location in Manhattan. And now, of course, we've got multiple locations in Manhattan. But again, the world is a little different. I mean, more care is being provided outside the hospital today than before. Everything before was done in the hospital. Today has been done outside the hospital. So the whole environment is changing, and we want to be at the cutting edge of that change, which I think we are.
I don't think anybody would argue that. I want to ask you about the St. Patrick's Day Parade, largest in the entire world. You're accepting the role of Grand Marshal. Did you have reservations to begin with? Did you say to yourself, I don't know if I can take the time out. I don't know if this is for me.
No, I didn't have any reservations about saying yes. I was shocked that I was asked. So my first reaction when I was called was, because I had no idea, was like, why me? But I immediately said yes, because to me it's an extraordinary honor. I feel privileged to have been asked. I looked upon it as just a wonderful thing when you're asked to lead the Irish up, Fifth Avenue. I knew that it would have requirements and roles for me to play during the preceding month or two, and I never considered that to be overwhelming at all. My attitude to most things is, just go do it. Stop thinking about it, just go do it. So if they ask me to do 10 other things, I say, okay, I'm going to do the 10 other things. And people ask, well, how do you fit that in with everything else? I say, I'll figure it out. Do it.
That's how you do it.
I don't question that. I mean, look, you have all the time there is. If you organize yourself right, you'll be able to do almost everything that everybody asks you to do. So to me, it's not been burdensome. In fact, it's been absolutely educational, because even though, I'm a history buff and I did know a lot of the history, I was absolutely amazed by the resilience of these Irish organizations that have been around since the middle of the 1860s.
Right.
And to go to a meeting and you're sitting there and they put up the big sign that had these big posters and it says, this is the 140th annual gala. And you think about that for a spec and you think, they've been doing this for 140 years. Imagine how it started, why it started, and the persistence to maintain that tradition for all those years is something absolutely extraordinary. It just shows the resilience of the Irish. It shows the Irish spirit. It shows the Irish tradition. And it shows the commitment to celebrate what is that which is Irish. But the other thing that is amazing at all of these events I've been at is that how proud they are to be Americans.
Absolutely.
And how they are to be Irish. So they became American, but never lost their Irish roots. So, it's that combination that they look upon the U.S. as being one of the greatest places in the world.
Sure.
And they have contributed, the Irish have contributed to making it the greatest place in the world.
Yeah.
And so it's been a wonderful education for me to be at these meetings, and I have another one tomorrow night, to be at these meetings every week, and just, you have to put everything in historical context, you know.
Yes.
People's memories are very short, but I have often sat on the dais at these places and sat and tried to think, now, what was life like in 1840 when they decided to create this entity? It was created for family, for networking, for support, for protection, because the history of immigration, you know, it's every immigrant group that ever came here was always, chastised by the group that had been here before.
Absolutely.
And everybody wants to be here, but they don't want the next group to be here. I mean, that's the history of immigration.
It's amazing, though, as it is with world hunger. We refer back to the Irish famine, and then we examine, well, how far have we actually come since then, and the hunger in the world, and so forth. Likewise, the topic of immigration, as you well pointed out, here are people fleeing the famine, and even before that, fleeing poverty. And then if you fast forward to today, the greatest topic, the topic that taking up time is, as with healthcare and healthcare reform, is the notion that we have enough immigrants, that somehow that this diversity thing, that it has a limit. Okay, if you're the right color, if you come from the right background and so forth, you're welcome. But have you seen, or a line as vivid as the line we have now, where it's actually now the very thing that we would all have been embarrassed to say as little as a few years ago, now we're saying, and now we're rooting out people to see, are you on this side? Are you on that side? And where does that land?
Well,
immigration.
A little bit of historical context. I mean, we've been through situations like this before in the history of the U.S., where periodically over the 100 years, there have been periods when there have been efforts to kind of keep certain groups out, limit their entry. People are having vicious debates about the fact that this group won't ever integrate to the U.S. They're lazy, they're this, that, they are. That was said about the Irish too when they came.
Definitely. No Irish need apply.
No Irish need apply. There was legislation passed to keep Italians out, etc., etc. So if you look at it historically, it's been, a continuous debate. Today, however, the nastiness of the debate, the crazy rhetoric that is used today,
across the board. Yeah.
And again, I think I would like for people who make these outlandish statements today that somebody should sit them down and teach them a little bit about history, and also teach them a little bit about the United States. The United States' history is the history of immigration. And the United States was the sanctuary that allowed people from all over the world to come, most of them with nothing other than the dream about being successful and having freedom, etc., and having an opportunity. The U.S. is about immigration. The unbelievable success of the U.S. is because of the work of the immigrants. And now to say to yourself that, to say that we might have a policy that would foreclose and block the borders because we have enough here, I think is unbelievably un-American. I mean, it doesn't subscribe to the principles underlying what America is all about at all. Now, I'm not at all opposed to, as has been the case in the past as well, if you know that there are people coming here to just do damage to the U.S., we should be keeping those people out. Or vetting them so strongly, it is very difficult. But that's not the... This is a handful of people. So you got to be careful.
And taking people again, Mike darling, taking people who have been here, who actually have been here in the shadows, who have little to benefit by way of their contribution to Social Security, to health care, to their longevity, to even put on the table that, you know, the fact that they should be thrown out, never mind who's coming in next.
Right, and like right now, for example, you've got about 50,000 Irish.
That's right.
Here that are undocumented, that are contributing, that are working and contributing. Many have families, etc., etc. Same with many, many other groups. And if you're going to have an immigration policy, it should be done carefully and humanely. You shouldn't be breaking up families, mm-hmm. right? You shouldn't be doing crazy things like having the mother leave and having the kids be here and say that you're family-oriented. It's depressing at the moment to listen to some of the rhetoric that is emanating from some people who, I think, in many views, just don't have a historical perspective. And I don't think, you know, they use it for political purposes.
Absolutely.
Not necessarily because it's good policy. You need good immigration policy, not bad immigration politics.
So well said. Limerick and Knockaderry will never be the same after this St. Patrick's Day. Family, your friends are not letting you walk the avenue without being there to cheer.
My whole family is coming from Ireland. Coming next week, they will be here. They will all march in the St. Patrick's Day parade. And... that's just absolutely wonderful, since I'm the only one in the United States. All the rest of them are in Ireland, but they're all coming over. And it just shows you the power of St. Patrick's Day. It brings families together.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, and again, congratulations to this year's Grand Marshal of the New York St. Patrick's Day Parade, Michael J. Dowling.